What do you do if you're a detective in the Miami-Dade Police Department down in Miami, Florida, and you receive a tip from a reliable, confidential informant that a person is engaged in drug activity and has drugs and weapons in the back of a duplex in Miami? Well, you check it out.
Bringing you the latest case law updates on the legal aspects of law enforcement. This is Broadcast Blue.
This is Broadcast Blue, and I'm your host, Bruce Allen Barnard. And today, I am presenting what I've called the case of the backside duplex. The case of the week for this edition of Bruce's Brown Bag Wednesday webinar, edition 11 for this year, is United States versus Maxey. There's also a co-defendant in this case, and the appeals were consolidated, and that person's name is Blank, B-L-A-N-C. And so the case is actually styled United States of America versus Maxey and Blank, including their AKAs. But the Blank side of this case really doesn't apply to the legal aspects of law enforcement. So our focus is going to be on the appeal from the one defendant, Willis Maxey, in this case. This decision was published on April 5th of 2018, and it comes to us from my circuit, from the 11th Circuit, sitting in Atlanta, which includes the state of Florida, where I'm coming to you from today, broadcasting from today. And this case originated in the Southern District of Florida. So let's take a look at what happened, the facts that actually led to this case. In July of 2012, the Miami-Dade Police Department received a tip from a confidential informant that a person known to the confidential informant by the alias Papa D had engaged in drug activity and also kept firearms in one of the two units of a duplex located on 64th Street in Miami, Florida. Now, if you're joining me live in the webinar presentation of Bruce's Brown Bag Wednesday, or if you're watching the video recording of that webinar, you will actually see the unit that is in question here. This is the duplex that you see on the screen. For those of you who are listening on the podcast and you have no visual, this duplex isn't a side-by-side. It's a front and back. There are two units of this duplex, two units of this property, and when you come up to the property, there's fencing across the front, a driveway. You have to drive through a fenced-in gate to get up to the driveway, but the second unit isn't to the side. It's not a side-by-side. The second unit is in the rear, and so you have to go past the front unit, around the side, and to the back in order to get to the entryway, the doorway of the rear unit. So it's the rear unit that is the unit that is at issue here. So to answer the question I asked up front, what do you do if you're a detective in the Miami-Dade Police Department and you get the tip? Well, you follow up on it and you put the unit under surveillance, which is exactly what they did down there in Miami. One officer set up to watch the house itself, the duplex, while others were positioned close by. And after setting up, just 10 or 15 minutes after setting up, officers saw two men leave that rear duplex and get into a truck. They stopped the truck, which is a seizure under the Fourth Amendment, right? They stopped the truck about a quarter mile from the duplex and asked the men for identification. There were two people in the vehicle, Mr. Blank and Mr. Pierre. And they did a search of the vehicle. And after they searched the vehicle, they found no contraband. They let the men leave. And then when they left, they turned around and went back towards the duplex. Now, Detective Ogden is sitting there. He's waiting. And when he is told that the truck is returning to the duplex, he orders all of the officers in the area to go to the duplex as well. So these masked officers come together. Five police cars holding approximately 10 police officers all pull up to the duplex. And after they saw all these officers come in, Mr. Blank took off running from the truck. Both him and Mr. Pierre were detained, and they were eventually released without being charged with anything. So they detained these folks to keep them from going to that rear duplex to warn anyone who's potentially there. So now the officers, having detained these two, they approach the rear, the door of the back unit, which is the rear of the property. Four or five officers run to the door of the back unit, and then the remaining officers, five or six officers, assume strategic positions, tactical positions, really, around the duplex. The door to the unit was not visible from the street. So to get to it, the officers had to pass through this gate in the chain link fence that you can see if you're watching the video that surrounds the yard. Now, as you might imagine, the door itself had an exterior metal security gate with a wooden interior door behind it. There was about 5 to 6 inches between the metal security gate and the door itself. And the metal security gate had bars that were 5 to 6 inches apart as well. And so they could actually reach through. Detective Ogden actually reached through the bars and knocked on the door. Detective Ogden testified he was pretty sure that no one announced police when he knocked on the door, which will be an important factor later on when we get into the analysis from the circuit court. So who opens the door? It's Mr. Maxey, the defendant in this case. We finally get to the first appearance of the person that we're talking about here. Mr. Maxey opens that wooden interior door right after Detective Ogden knocks on it. Behind Mr. Maxey, Detective Ogden testified he could see a clear mixing bowl as well as a white plate, with the plate having naked crack rocks and the clear mixing bowl having packaged crack cocaine and a razor blade on the plate and a scrap piece of paper. Detective Ogden said that these objects were 5 to 10 feet away from his position at the door. Now, when Mr. Maxey sees that it's Detective Ogden and police officers, once he opens the door, he attempts to fade off out of view, but Detective Ogden orders him to stay where he is. He starts talking to Mr. Maxey. Mr. Maxey tells him that he didn't live at the duplex and that he didn't know who did. And Detective Ogden asked Maxey to step outside, but Maxey said he couldn't because the metal security gate was locked and he didn't have a key. So at this point, Detective Ogden asks Maxey if he's burglarizing the residence. And Maxey responds, "Oh, I will go for burglary." At some point during this interchange, Detective Ogden told Mr. Maxey that he was under arrest. The officers then decided to force open the security gate because they were concerned that Mr. Maxey would destroy evidence. And once the gate was pried open, Detective Ogden pulled Mr. Maxey out of the building and handcuffed him. And then approximately five officers went into the unit and did a protective sweep of the unit, what you might know as a buoy sweep. Detective Ogden said that took about 2 minutes. During the sweep, they saw more packaged crack cocaine, they saw semi-automatic handguns, four rifles, and a stack of money. After the sweep, the officers left the unit and applied for a search warrant. There's no indication in the facts that they did a plain view seizure, which is a little interesting. And so the basis of the warrant was on the observation and not on any evidence that had been seized as a result of the protective sweep under the plain view seizure doctrine. There's not any indication that anything was taken, at least in the facts as they're presented. And here's an interesting little twist. After they did the protective sweep, but before they did the search warrant application, the affidavit, there was another police officer, Lieutenant Almaguer, and another officer who did a walkthrough of the unit. And the purpose of the walkthrough, remember this is after the protective sweep, was to verify what they were writing in the search warrant application is actually what they saw. So they're trying to verify what it was they saw during the protective sweep in order to make sure that the warrant application is accurate, which is even another one more indication that the plain view, there was no plain view seizure. They do this walkthrough, this pre-warrant application walkthrough, and when the search warrant application was submitted, the officers testified that they did not rely on any of the observations from the walkthrough. After the search warrant was issued, starting around 2 o'clock in the morning, the officers went back inside the unit, and then they collected crack cocaine, they took the firearms, they found Mr. Maxey's driver's license, and other papers. Now, getting back to Mr. Maxey here, once the search was over, remember, he's under arrest. Once the search was over, Maxey was advised of his Miranda rights in the back of the police car. An officer also told Mr. Maxey that the police had seen guns and drugs in the house. So they tell him about the evidence that they have found after they Mirandize him. Several hours later, Mr. Maxey signed a formal waiver of his Miranda rights and was interviewed. He told the police that he worked as a cut man for this person, Papa D, and he said he cut up and bagged crack cocaine, provided security, and resupplied other locations with the crack cocaine, which is effectively a confession. In February of 2014, Mr. Maxey, along with other co-defendants that aren't a part of the case today, were indicted for crimes relating to this drug conspiracy. He was charged with conspiracy to possess with intent to distribute a controlled substance, possession with intent to distribute a controlled substance, possession of a firearm in furtherance of a drug trafficking crime, and finally, possession of a firearm by a convicted felon. Now, you know what's going to happen. The defense attorney's going to file that motion, say, hey, this isn't fair, use the defense F word, and file these motions to suppress. The defense attorney in this case filed motions to suppress evidence based on violations of the constitutional rights of Mr. Maxey. He filed a motion to suppress the physical evidence that was found at the unit, as well as statements that were made related to the search at the duplex and what took place after he was arrested. Specifically, at the suppression hearing, Mr. Maxey's attorney argued that the police officer's approach to the duplex exceeded the scope of the permissible knock-and-talk exception. He also argued that Mr. Maxey did not voluntarily open the duplex door, and the fact they actually ended up breaking the screen door down, but when he opened the door, it wasn't voluntary, and that each of the police officer's actions that followed, breaking down the door, the protective sweep, the pre-warrant walkthrough, and the arrest were all unlawful under the Fourth Amendment. He also argued that Mr. Maxey's statements should be suppressed as fruit of the poisonous tree. Of course, the government opposed these motions. The government argued that first, Mr. Maxey didn't have standing to challenge the search. And then they argued the police approach to the door was permissible under the knock and talk exception, and that Mr. Maxey's opening of the door was voluntary. They also argued that even if the officer's actions after approaching the door were impermissible, there was still sufficient information to support the search warrant because they could see the crack cocaine in plain sight from the door. In the report and recommendation, commonly called the R&R, that was issued by the magistrate judge, he recommended that Mr. Maxey's motion be denied. The magistrate judge found that Mr. Maxey opened the door voluntarily and that the officer's protective sweep of the duplex was justified. The magistrate judge also found that the pre-warrant walkthrough violated the Fourth Amendment, that walkthrough that took place after the protective sweep but before the warrant was applied for. The magistrate found that did violate the Fourth Amendment, but that the crack cocaine observed by the officers in plain sight once the door was opened provided an independent source of probable cause to support the search warrant. So talking about the independent source doctrine. And so that was the finding of the magistrate judge, which was adopted by the district court, which denied Mr. Maxey's motion to suppress. Mr. Maxey went to trial in April of 2015, and a jury found him guilty on all counts, and he was sentenced to 312 months of imprisonment. As you might expect, the defense attorney filed an appeal, and on appeal to the 11th Circuit, the United States Circuit Court of Appeals for the 11th Circuit, the five issues were: one, did Mr. Maxey have standing to challenge the search of the property? Two, was the entry onto the curtilage a Fourth Amendment violation? Three, did Mr. Maxey open the interior wooden door voluntarily? Four, did the police violate the Fourth Amendment by entering the house? And five, was the protective sweep and subsequent walkthrough lawful? Those are your five Fourth Amendment issues. And then we have a Sixth Amendment issue. Should the statements be suppressed? The statements, basically the confession that Mr. Maxey made, should that be suppressed as fruit of the poisonous tree as a result of the Fourth Amendment violations? In the first issue, the court addressed the question of whether Mr. Maxey actually had standing to challenge the search of the property. In other words, if it wasn't his Fourth Amendment rights that were violated, then he can't use that in order to invoke the exclusionary rule. So did he even have any Fourth Amendment rights in the property to begin with? The court cited the Supreme Court decision, Rockus versus Illinois, and stated that the mere presence where the search occurred is not enough to confer standing. An overnight guest would be able to establish standing. The fact that someone's an overnight guest establishes REP, a reasonable expectation of privacy in a residence sufficient to establish standing. And that comes to us from the Minnesota versus Olson decision of the Supreme Court. But a guest that's only there for a brief type of transaction, only for a brief period of time, does not have standing. And that comes to us from Minnesota versus Carter, yet another Supreme Court decision. So based on these three Supreme Court decisions, and applied to the fact that Mr. Maxey stated that he'd been living at the duplex for 3 to 6 months, and he kept important papers like food stamp cards, Social Security, and Western Union papers at the duplex, and the fact that he had paid half the rent to the duplex and had a key. Based on all of that, the court concluded that Mr. Maxey had standing to challenge the search. So moving on to our next Fourth Amendment domino, the second Fourth Amendment issue that the court had to answer was the question, was the entry onto the curtilage itself a Fourth Amendment violation? In other words, did the knock and talk exception apply to this entry upon the curtilage made by the police officers? Now, the Miami-Dade Police Department is very familiar with this concept of the knock and talk exception, that implied license to approach someone's front door in order to attempt to have a consensual encounter. And they know what the requirements are because it was the Miami-Dade Police Department that was involved with Frankie, the famous drug-sniffing dog down there in Miami-Dade, that chocolate Labrador retriever, in the Florida versus Jardines decision. And remember, this knock and talk exception allows the police officers to go to the place that a person would normally receive uninvited guests in an attempt to have a consensual encounter. There are both place restrictions and where you go to do this. It has to be the place where they would normally receive uninvited guests, and it has to be during the time that you would expect that. We had a case out of California not too long ago where they went to the back door, or went up to the front door at 2 o'clock in the morning to try and contact old Whitey there in that particular case, and the court said, hey, look, that 2 o'clock in the morning isn't a time when people would normally receive uninvited guests. So it has to be at the place and at a time, and it has to be done in a way that people who were an uninvited guest, the manner that they would come up to the door in order to have this encounter. And remember, and Justice Scalia told us, hey, this isn't difficult. Just tell us, you know, just Justice Scalia reminded us this really isn't rocket science, right? You can figure out where this is by looking, where do the trick-or-treaters go? Where do the Girl Scouts go to sell their cookies? And so there is a place and a time restriction and a manner, the manner that you're going to conduct this consensual encounter. And recall in the Jardines case, they took Frankie to the front door. And the Supreme Court said, hey, look, that did not apply. The knock and talk exception, that license doesn't extend to having a drug sniffing dog at the front door, that the police officers can go to the front door to attempt to knock on the door to have an encounter, to talk to somebody, and they can do that, but they can't take the dog with them. And so there are limits to this knock and talk exception. So the court noted that there was no doubt the officers breached the curtilage. In other words, they were standing in the curtilage of the duplex. And remember from United States versus Dunn, if you are standing in the curtilage of the house, it's just like you're standing in the house itself. To physically be in the curtilage is the same as physically being inside the house, and therefore you have physically intruded into a constitutionally protected area, which makes it a search under the Fourth Amendment. So it is a search. The fact they were standing in the curtilage makes it a search. The question is, do they have this JRE, this judicially recognized exception under the knock and talk exception that would allow them to do that lawfully? The court noted that the officer's physical intrusion was not limited to the front door, geographically limited. In fact, the officers testified they took up tactical positions not just at the front door, but around the perimeter of the duplex. And secondly, the court noted that the officer's intent in approaching the duplex wasn't that of an ordinary citizen. They weren't attempting to have a consensual encounter. They were going up to the front door in order to detain anyone that they found inside the duplex and secure the duplex. And because these actions did not qualify under the knock and talk exception, the court ruled that the officers did not have a license under that particular JRE to enter the curtilage of the duplex. Now, fortunately for the prosecution, that's not the end of the inquiry, because even if you have a Fourth Amendment violation, it doesn't automatically mean that the exclusionary rule is appropriate and will be applied. So the court went on to cite the Hudson v. Michigan Supreme Court decision from 2006, where the Supreme Court held that the exclusion of evidence was not required when the police officers committed a Fourth Amendment violation by failing to knock and announce when executing a warrant under the knock and announce rule. They drew an analogy, and they said that here the constitutional violation of the officers did not result in the production of evidence. It was the manner in which they approached the house that created the problem, not the fact that they approached at all. If Detective Ogden had walked up the path to the front door alone without anyone else and knocked and waited briefly, he would have conducted a proper knock and talk. And so had things occurred that way, the result would have been the same. So the constitutional violation, the presence of all the other officers assuming tactical positions in the yard, there's no evidence to suggest anything would have turned out differently if they'd done it correctly as opposed to the way that they did it. Mr. Maxey opened the door almost immediately after he knocked, and Detective Ogden would have observed everything that he observed the same way. It appears that Mr. Maxey, because they did not announce who they were, police, it appears from the facts of the case that he didn't know. He was totally unaware of what was developing outside the house. So the court notes that sometimes a knock and talk violation will result in the exclusionary rule, as it did, indeed it did, in the Florida versus Jardines decision. But in this particular case, the constitutional violations did not produce the contested evidence, and therefore the court concluded that exclusion of the evidence was not the appropriate remedy. The next issue was, did Mr. Maxey open the door voluntarily? Mr. Maxey argues that he did not open the door voluntarily. He argued that given the number of police officers on the property, the unlawful seizure and detention of two individuals while on the property, and where at least one of the officers approached the front door with his weapon drawn, a reasonable person would believe they had no other option but to open the door. But the problem is that there was no evidence to show that Mr. Maxey knew any of this at the point in time he opened the door, and he didn't rely on any of that information when he opened the door. And so there was no indication or facts to support the argument that he opened the door in response to a show of official authority, which is what's required in order to successfully make this argument. In this particular case, the magistrate found that Mr. Maxey did not open the door in response to the show of authority, and this is supported by the fact that he was seemed surprised at seeing the police. And his immediate attempt when he opened the door, his immediate response to that was to try and move out of view and try and back away and sneak away from the door, that none of the facts supported a finding that he expected police to be at the door when he opened it. And therefore, the district court did not err in finding that Mr. Maxey voluntarily opened the door. The next issue, the fourth issue, is did the police violate the Fourth Amendment by entering the house when they forced that metal outer security gate open and actually went into the house? Was this a Fourth Amendment violation? The court noted the rule of law from previous established 11th Circuit precedent. To justify a warrantless arrest in a person's home, the government has to have both probable cause and the presence of exigent circumstances, such as the risk of removal or destruction of evidence, or a danger to the arresting officers or to the public, or hot pursuit. Any of those, the three normal, the typical types of exigent circumstances that I've discussed before. And so it's not enough. Finding a probable cause alone doesn't get you into the house. There has to be some type of exigent circumstances in order to have a warrantless entry into the home. The court ruled in this particular issue that Mr. Maxey's warrantless arrest was supported both by probable cause and by exigent circumstances. The court said that there was a risk that the evidence he saw would be destroyed if the police left the duplex to get an arrest warrant, so that they had probable cause to believe he committed a crime, and it was objectively reasonable for them to think that exigent circumstances existed to justify their entry into the house without a warrant. There are no cases there are certainly no Supreme Court cases that were cited in making any of these determinations that there's a risk that the evidence he saw would be destroyed if they left to get a warrant. And that's not really the test. This is the one part of the decision where you kind of scratch your head a little bit and you're reading through it and you're like, because we have plenty of cases, both circuit court decisions and Supreme Court decisions, that say it's not enough to say that there's the possibility, that there's just a mere risk of the destruction of evidence in order to invoke the destruction of evidence exigency for exigent circumstances. The destruction has to be imminent. They have to articulate facts. They have to articulate the facts that would lead a reasonable person to believe that the evidence is about to be destroyed or is being destroyed. Typically in these cases, we have police knock on the door and then we hear they have probable cause that there's drugs inside, and then they have articulable facts they can articulate that lead them to believe the evidence is actually being destroyed. In the very famous Supreme Court decision in Kentucky versus King, we actually had the sounds of destruction, the communication between the two people inside the apartment. And we see that a lot in these cases. We see toilets flushing or sinks running, the disposal unit being turned on, or people saying, get rid of this. But we didn't have any of that. And here it was just the risk that the evidence would be destroyed if the police left the duplex to get a warrant. And that's a little weak, but that's what they said, and that's the way the ruling was. So we're gonna rock and roll with it. But the only reason I mention anything is because to the extent that you're using this podcast as a takeaway, hopefully the people listening to this, it's a want to learn something from these cases. I really wouldn't hang my hat on this one, this one particular issue where they said that just because there's a risk that the evidence would be destroyed if they left to get a warrant. That's not the test. It's a little bit more strict than that and a little bit more stringent. And so you might not want to hang your hat on this particular issue. The fifth issue deals with the protective sweep, and they went inside to arrest him, and we're working down these Fourth Amendment dominoes. Because remember, if any of the previous Fourth Amendment decisions, if the court had ruled that they were a problem, then you would have issues with the downstream dominoes, right? And even though the court said we had a Fourth Amendment violation with the curtilage, they said the exclusionary rule wasn't the remedy, so they kind of cured the domino through the lack of the application of the exclusionary rule. We're moving down these Fourth Amendment decisions one after the other, and now we're to the point where they did the protective sweep and then the walkthrough. So remember, there were two separate searches that occurred. The protective sweep was a search that occurred, and then we had the walkthrough before they did filled out the search warrant application. They did that walkthrough. Well, the court kind of skirted the issue as to whether or not these two events, either or both of the events, were improper or illegal under the Fourth Amendment, and they jumped straight to another exception of the exclusionary rule, which is called the independent source doctrine. And the independent source doctrine allows the admission of evidence that has been discovered by means of a wholly independent source other than the constitutional violation. And the Supreme Court decision for this is the Nix v. Williams decision. And there's two separate steps. First, you take away from the search warrant affidavit any information that was gained during that illegal initial search. And then you look to see the second part of the test, if the remaining information establishes probable cause, did the officer's decision to seek the warrant, was that prompted by what they saw during the illegal portion of the part that is arguably illegal activity? If the officer would have sought the warrant even without the illegal search, then the evidence will be admissible under this independent source doctrine. And the court said that even if the protective sweep and the walkthrough were illegal, the evidence found inside the duplex is admissible. It meets these two steps, these two prongs of the independent source doctrine. Mr. Maxey voluntarily opened the door, and as a result of that, Detective Ogden saw his observation of what was inside the house, the crack rocks, the bowl of the packaged drugs that were 5-10 feet behind him, and all of the drug-making paraphernalia, everything that he observed from the open door would establish probable cause. That'd be sufficient for a finding of probable cause to get a warrant. So even if they hadn't done what they had done, even if they hadn't done the probable or the protective sweep, or what we would call a buoy sweep, even if they hadn't done the buoy sweep, or even if they hadn't done that walkthrough, that pre-warrant walkthrough, they still would have had what they needed, and they still would have sought a warrant based on the observation of Detective Ogden from the front door. And therefore, the independent source doctrine would thwart the exclusionary rule being applied. So now we have a situation where we've had three separate Fourth Amendment violations, but the exclusionary rule has not yet been applied because of these exceptions to the exclusionary rule. The last issue to be decided was, should the statements be suppressed as fruit of the poisonous tree? And the court stated that because they had concluded that the constitutional violations of the officers did not cause Mr. Maxey to open the door, and an independent source of evidence supported his arrest once the door was open, that the statements need not be excluded. Remember, statements that are fruit of an illegal search are typically excluded, and the Supreme Court decision for that is Wong Sun versus United States. But This is only excludable if it derives immediately from an unlawful entry and an unauthorized arrest. And again, the court said here the constitutional violations did not cause him to open the door, and this independent source supported his arrest, and therefore this rule of exclusion would not apply under the fruit of the poisonous tree for statements made as a result of an illegal search, and therefore they ruled in favor of the government in this issue as well. So the decision of the district court denying the motion to suppress on all of the argued grounds was affirmed by the 11th Circuit in this case. Well, now it's time for a little bit of editorial, where I usually add my 2 cents worth. And this I'm calling things that make you go, Boy, there were a lot of things that didn't quite go as well as they could have in this particular case. And so to the extent it's a learning lesson for everybody, maybe we ought to spend just a couple minutes talking about these things that make you go, What about all of the events that led up to the point in time where they knocked on the door? Remember, they've got a confidential informant that gives them a reliable tip that there's drugs and there are firearms in this duplex right then and there at this point in time. And to the extent that under Aguilar and Gates, they can establish the reliability of this confidential informant, it might be that the confidential informant alone could establish the probable cause in order to get a warrant to go search that rear duplex. So if they put him under surveillance, maybe they could gather some more information if they wanted to bolster that Fourth Amendment probable cause a little bit. But they stop the car. When the two guys come out of the apartment, they drive off in a truck, Pierre and Blanc, and they drive away in the trunk. They stop the truck, and then they search it, and they don't find anything, and they let them go, and they go back to the duplex, and they follow them back to the duplex, and they stop them, and they detain them again, which is another seizure. We've got all kinds of searches and seizures that are taking place here in a warrantless environment, and kind of questionable, and it kind of makes you go, what exactly is going on? That's not a part of any of this particular decision, but it's certainly something to think about. The fact that the court didn't require a little bit more for the destruction exigency, I've already noted, was a little interesting, makes you scratch your head just a little bit. This case could have gone a totally different way in a lot of different situations. A lot of these issues could have come out a little bit differently. We got very favorable ruling by the court in some areas where it was kind of iffy. And I also wanted to point out, we had 3 Fourth Amendment violations just in this case, not counting the Fourth Amendment violations potentially that occurred before Mr. Maxey answered the door. There were 3 or 4 more, arguably, Fourth Amendment violations that occurred. Even when the court says that the exclusionary rule is not going to be applied, what they're saying is that they're already acknowledging that there's a Fourth Amendment violation, and they did in this case. They fully acknowledged that there were 3 Fourth Amendment violations, and so that creates problems for the officers. Just because the evidence is eventually admitted doesn't mean that you're not going to get sued in a Bivens action or in a 1983 action for violating the Fourth Amendment. That's not the end-all be-all, although it's certainly from a prosecutor's standpoint, and when I was prosecuting, I would certainly want the evidence coming in. But just understand that when you've got a Fourth Amendment violation, it's not just the exclusion of the evidence that you need to be concerned about. So we've got a lot of incentive, notwithstanding the exceptions to the exclusionary rule. There's incentive to make the right Fourth Amendment decisions and to do things the right way. Cross your T's and dot your I's. This one turned out okay in the end, but it certainly could have gone a different direction with just a very few changes in the facts. Thank you for joining me on this edition of Bruce's Brown Bag Wednesday here on Broadcast Blue. Don't forget to check out our website, broadcast.blue, for all kinds of information. You can listen to the podcast on Broadcast Blue, and you can get information for how to watch the videos. If you're listening to the podcast and you're thinking, I didn't know there was a video that went along with this audio, and you actually want to watch the video, you can do that on our Vimeo channel at www.brownbag.video. And if you can't remember that, all you got to remember is broadcast.blue. Our name is our website address, www.broadcast.blue, and all the information, how to get to the webinars, how to get to the videos, you can even listen to the podcast, you can subscribe for iTunes and Google Play, all from the website at broadcast.blue. A new thing we've just started last week is actually doing something called the Blue Blog. I am actually doing legal updates as blog entries and with a link to the full PDF of the decision as they come out. And so these decisions come out within a day or two, typically on the same day that I get notification of it. I am actually putting together blog entries on this, the Blue Blog, where you can read it and read the Blue Blog. And don't forget, we've got some more different types of podcasts coming up besides the Brown Bag Wednesday webinars in the not too distant future, the Blue Key Cases and the Blue Shorts. And so make sure that you check out the website for information on all of that. Again, thank you so much for what you do. Appreciate you taking the time to be with me today. Tell a friend. Take the time to tell some other folks. Tell some coworkers, some people that you work with, and get the word out on what the resources that are available for you at www.broadcast.blue. And I hope to see you again real soon.